have a man who was impoverished but was good, and you see the ultimate consequences of this. Another good example of a parable with good and bad are the wise and foolish virgins. Kind of interesting that these young girls have their entire life, in a sense, summed up in those words, wise and foolish. Now, of course, the parable of the wise and foolish virgins set in the scene of them with their lamps waiting for the bridegroom to come and the celebration to begin. They have their lamps and their oil, and five of them are ill-prepared. And they end up having to go back to town in order to get more oil, and they miss the wedding celebration. That's considered foolish. The five wise ones have enough oil and are prepared so that they're ready when the bridegroom comes and the celebration begins. That entire scenario is actually a metaphor for the coming of Christ, the return of Jesus. Preparation, being ready when he comes and the celebration begins. Some will be foolish and will be ill-prepared, not ready. Others will be wise and will have prepared themselves. So Jesus often uses these vast contrasts between people. Now, here today, we have an interesting situation because it's the parable as we know it as the Good Samaritan. And there are individuals opposite him in the account. One is a priest, the other is a Levite. We don't know it as the Good Samaritan and the bad priest and bad Levite. That's getting a little close to home, you know, for the professional clergy. You know, when you have priests and Levites, the religious leaders of the day, do we want to call them bad? Well, I don't know. Let's hold off on that. But let's see what's wrong with these individuals and look at the story a little bit in greater depth here. The classic account that the Sunday school children see starts with Jesus' story in verse 30, where he discusses the man going down on the road to Jericho, and he falls into the hands of robbers. He's beaten and left for dead, and he ends up being passed by two individuals. We have a Levite and a priest who both determine not to help but to pass by. And then we see a Samaritan who takes pity on him, binds up his wounds, ends up going and taking him to an inn where he could recover, pays the full bill, and in the end is a true godly representative to this man who had fallen. Now, the context is what the Sunday school children often don't look at. And this is where the whole account of the Good Samaritan, the parable, is in response to an individual who is discussing with Jesus, how can I fulfill the law? That's how it starts in verse 25. On one occasion, an expert in the law stood up to test Jesus. This testing was not uncommon. The Jews would often spar a little bit. Sometimes it was very friendly and intended to sharpen one another. Other times it was more contentious. But it was not uncommon to have the religious experts, the priests, testing one another. So he asked the question, you know, what do you think about this, Jesus? And he says, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus responds, what's written in the law? His answer, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. These are responses straight out of the Old Testament, and it is correct. You got to have love toward God, or else your relationship with others are going to be misguided. On the other hand, how can you say you love God if you have ill will and hatred toward your fellow man? You have to have both. You need to have a sincere desire for God as well as compassion and tenderness toward other people, or else something is really out of kilter. All right, so he answers correctly, and then Jesus tells him, you have answered correctly, do this and you will live. And then we get to an interesting statement. But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, And who is my neighbor? He's seeking technical information. And we're going to talk about that in just a few minutes. But for now, we start with the parable itself. There is a man who is on the road to Jericho, and he goes down to Jericho, and he is besieged by robbers and beaten and left for dead. Why is this guy on the road to Jericho? What is the deal with the road to Jericho? Jerusalem is a very high elevation. And the road, by the way, you know, we always think in terms of highways and cars, and, you know, this is our world. But in the ancient world, this might have been more like a well-traveled footpath. The Romans at the time had built roads, but these were typically like stone roads. They could be rather wide. Nevertheless, this would have been a very difficult road to travel because of the elevation difference between Jerusalem, which was in the hills, and Jericho, which was down near the Dead Sea. So this would have been a long, tiring, hot walk through what was known as the wilderness area. It, even today, is still very impressive when the tour buses go through this region and go from Jericho back up to Jerusalem. There's a lot of switchbacks. It's a very tricky route for bus drivers to drive. And so there's often times when you're looking out the side of the window and you don't even see the road. It's sort of like in the Rockies when you look down and there's nothing but drop-off. So this is a difficult road. This is why many individuals in the ancient world, typically they would start out very early in the morning and get their walking done in the morning and get done about noon to avoid the heat of the day, and then they would rest. We don't know what time this individual was walking on the road to Jericho. Jesus doesn't say, you know, in the third hour of the day or something like that. There's no indication. Did this story suppose that this individual had to travel at night? We don't know. If that was the understanding, if that was the context, then you can see why the bandits, the road robbers would come. You know, Father's Day. Fathers often try to teach their families common sense, wisdom. You know, whereas if a child does something that's a little bit senseless and that and hurts themselves, a mother might go, "Oh, no, poor baby." You know, and dad will say, "Well, that was stupid." Well, the father might come with the attitude, you know, "Why was this guy traveling down the road alone like this?" You know, we'd ask those kind of questions. You know, what kind of fool is going to go on a trip where you know there might be robbers and you're traveling all by yourself, right? This is the way dads think. Well, Jesus doesn't lead us to any conclusions on that. It's not a situation where he prompts us to ask those kind of questions. He simply presents us with the situation. The man had gotten beaten up. He was in need of help. And oftentimes that's where we find ourselves when we're called upon to be the hands and the feet of Jesus. We're not asked to assess the intelligence of the individual, why they did such a foolish thing, things like that. We're simply confronted with a need, and we have to make the decision to respond or not. And so the man is in dire straits, and we have two religious authority figures that come along. This is where there really would have been a heightened interest in Jesus' story, because he selects as a contrast in characters in the story two of the religious hierarchy, a priest and a Levite. Now, the Levites were known for their commitment to God and purity. It was from the Levites that the priestly class was selected. So Jesus is definitely zeroing in here on the individuals who claimed moral and religious, shall we say, excellence, commitment, recognition that they should have received. And so these individuals are contrasted with the Samaritan. Focusing on these two individuals, the priest and the Levite, Why do they pass on the other side? It just sounds really harsh, doesn't it? Is this just a simple condemnation of these men, or is there perhaps more to it? Now, you know how it is. When you come upon a situation and you're judging whether or not to help and all, there's contingencies, there's issues, right? For instance, what if you see someone broken down by the side of the road? Or what if you see someone that needs help, but you're in a rush? You know how that is. You feel this pull. You feel this tension. Oh, no, I don't have much time, right? That's a classic one that can cause us to say, oh, I can't stop and help. Well, we don't know if that was in play. Another thing. Something that we don't give a lot of thought or attention to, but that was very, very involved in Jesus' day, was ritualistic purity. For a priest and a Levite, it was extremely important that they maintained purity. They were all into these hand washings and the wearing of certain clothes. Purity in every respect, every sense, was highly honored, and it was sought. Purity as far as what you looked at. And that's why they actually had one of my favorite things about how intensely legalistic the priests and the Levites could be was that they actually had what were called the bruised and bleeding Pharisees. And you wonder, what are the bruised and bleeding Pharisees? These were the individuals who wanted to keep themselves so pure that they would not look upon evil. They would not look upon something wrong. So when it came to women, these guys would actually, when they were walking, if they would see a woman, they would actually close their eyes so that they would not lust, so that they would not have the impure thoughts. And they would sometimes walk into objects. So they were called the bruised and bleeding ones. See? Now, this is the kind of mindset that was going on at the time. So you don't want to defile yourself. What if you come near a dead body and it's close to the Sabbath? Then you're defiled. Then you're unclean. How can you celebrate if you're unclean? Now, to us, that sounds like this is ridiculous. But this was the culture, this was the mindset of Jesus' day. Now, these individuals, just to give you an idea of how wrapped up in kind of spiritual legalism they were, Jesus just explains to this teacher of the law here, he just tells him, you know, that he has answered correctly. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, your soul, and your mind, right? And love your neighbor as yourself. And we'd say, okay, great, there's the answer. And then what does he do? And he says, now I need further explanation. Who is my neighbor? Tell me, please explain, which individuals must I do this for? You see what I'm saying? Everything was all wrapped up in their rules, regulations, things like this. So these two guys that pass by probably are torn in their minds. If it's at night, you'd think twice too. What if it's at night and you see someone lying there? Could you mistakenly think they're already dead? Your next thought would be, oh no, if they got it, am I next? See? Now, the answer to all of this is we always conclude, this is an excuse, right? But those excuses are real to us, aren't they? They are real temptations not to help. And this is one of the reasons why I don't know that we can easily categorize the Levite and the priest as being bad. My guess is they were struggling with it, just the same as you and I struggle with it sometimes. And we have the same kind of question. When confronted with a situation where there's an obvious need, we have the same kind of tension. Do I get involved or not? And we run through the scenarios, and we look at the contingencies, and we determine, should I? With that in mind, Jesus' emphasis here is not so much on necessarily the failings of the priest and the Levite, but it's an emphasis on the wonderful acts of the Samaritan. Now, this does contrast the priest and the Levite. And one of the reasons Jesus chose them is because they were pure-blooded Jews. They were from the southern part of Israel, the Jerusalem region. They were not sellouts. They were not half-breeds. See, there was a ethnic tension, a religious and ethnic tension, between the Jews and the Samaritans. The Samaritans had been the Jews, the Samaritan people, came from the northern Jews after the fall of Samaria in 721 BC. The Jews in the north started to give in and intermarry against the law of God. They began to intermarry with the Canaanite cultures. And this is where the Samaritans from the region near Samaria, the capital in the north, this is where the Samaritan people start to come from. So it'd be very similar today that if you had a mixed marriage with someone who is Hispanic or black or whatever, and the Jews in the south who were pure blood despised the Samaritans. So this story is as much a condemnation of that racial attitude and religious kind of superiority mindset that the Jews had. And the Samaritan comes out looking very, very good. Now, we have to watch it that we don't have these same kind of attitudes and mindsets. I'll never forget one instance that really bothered me and sticks in my mind. Was when I was down at Walmart once several years ago, and I was walking through the parking lot toward the front door, and out of the Walmart shopping center with their cart and their groceries or whatever, and out comes a Hispanic family. And there was a white guy in a pickup truck who was driving through, and as this kind of convergence happened where I was walking past and the guy in the pickup truck with his window down and the Hispanic family coming along, I hear the guy in the pickup truck mutter loud enough for them to hear, of course, "Damn Mexicans." See? The attitude, the hatred, the condemnation, the inherent sense of superiority and disdain toward these other people. You don't know them from Adam. And you're filled with disgust over them. That's what was happening with the Jews toward the Samaritans. And so it's no accident that Jesus uses a Samaritan. In fact, more than once, Samaritans are used as glowing examples of godliness. Jesus is making a statement, let none of you have this racist, bigoted attitude, religiously or ethnically. So we see the Samaritan, and here's the beautiful thing. His nature is compassion. Well, maybe the Samaritan didn't want to become unclean either. Maybe the Samaritan was concerned about his safety as well. But in the end, it's not personal safety, and it's not religious purity that motivates the Samaritan. It's pity. This is what Jesus says, and this is what separates him from the others in verse 33. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came to where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. Now, there's nothing wrong with personal integrity and personal safety, and there's nothing wrong with purity, right, obviously. But what about when it's a tension between them and showing pity and compassion? This is the ultimate lesson of the Good Samaritan. Which is God going to value highest? Let's take an example from the Old Testament for a moment. I want to have you turn to Micah, the book of Micah, page 1446. Page 1446, Micah. We're We're in chapter 6 and looking at verse 6, which is of the highest worth to God. Not neglecting our responsibilities to Him, but which is ultimately the most like God, maintaining ritual purity and our religious observance, or acting in compassion. In Micah chapter 6, verse 6, with what shall I come before the Lord and bow down before the exalted God? Shall I come before Him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000 rivers of oil? Shall I offer my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has showed you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. This is what the Samaritan was doing. When he was confronted by the needs of this individual, his dire situation, he had compassion. He took pity on him. And you certainly can't escape the obvious that this Samaritan went way above the call of duty. He ends up pouring on oil and binding this man right there and helping him, giving him a trip on his donkey or whatever to the inn. There he is willing to pay the full bill for this man's recuperation. The Samaritan has his heart set on not just get the guy off the road and maybe slap a bandage on him, but to ensure that this man is brought back to full recovery. In that sense, the Samaritan is a symbol for God. God's principle is do whatever it takes to save the individual. And this is our lesson in the parable of the Good Samaritan. As Christians, it should not be minimal concern. It should be maximum concern. When we get involved in order to help, it should not be to brush somebody off, to get them off our conscience. It should be to show genuine, authentic assistance in the name of Jesus. The Good Samaritan is a call for us to exercise pity over personal safety and over purity. It's a concern for us to show love and not just legalism. It's a challenge from Jesus, especially when he concludes, go and do likewise. Amen.